Hey, dear listener, Anthony here. Before we hop into the show, I wanted to let you know about an incredible new resource we just released, The 5 Rules of Investing. Dan and I are huge advocates of modeling the behaviors of the people who have done what you hope to do. And who better to model when it comes to investing than legendary investors like Warren Buffett, Howard Marks, and Ray Dalio? This free ebook breaks down the simple time-tested strategies of billionaire real estate investors that you can use to take your investing to the next level. So head over to InvictusMultifamily.com and grab your ebook today. All right, now let's hop into the show.
Welcome to Multifamily Investing Made Simple, the podcast where we take the complexity out of investing in real estate so that you can get started today. I am one of the hosts, Dan Kruger, joined as always by Anthony Vecino. How are you doing today, Anthony?
I'm doing pretty good. I want to point out real quick that every time you do the intro, you are very specific, and it's clear you're the numbers guy in our relationship because you always say, I am one of your hosts. When I do the intro, I come in hot and I'm like, I'm your host. Also, I have a co-host over here, Dan.
He's here, but
you give props right away, and I appreciate that. It makes me feel important.
Yeah, you know, that's just how I roll. But we also have some other people on the podcast today, too. Well, not other people, just one.
Just one.
Today, we are joined by Spencer Hillegross. Spencer Hillegross.
No, I don't think there's an R in there. I think it's Hillegross.
Hillegross, you're right. Yeah. I'm reading it incorrectly. Mm-hmm. Spencer, I'm sorry.
You're like the thousandth person to get that name wrong.
It sounds okay, like it should be Hillegross, but it's Hillegross. Spencer Hillegross. Hillegross. I still want to say it. It's insane. Spencer Hillegross is a full-time real estate investor and former technology leader of 13 years. Spencer helps passive investors deploy capital into storage and multifamily syndications with vetted sponsors and deals. His company, Madison Investing, has co-sponsored deals totaling more than 5,000 units for more than $600 million. Spencer invests in syndications as an LP and actively leads Madison Investing alongside his co-founder, Jennifer Morimoto. Names, I struggle with
names. Spencer, you crushed it.
I hope you still want to be on our podcast after that intro. How are you?
I'm excited to be here.
Good. I love it. Those are some impressive numbers, man.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, are there typos? You said this says 5,000 units, $600 million. Those are typos, right? Those have too many zeros. That can't be possible.
A few years ago, I would have thought that, you know, I mean, I definitely, when I started this whole journey as a guy who was like just doing the corporate W-2 thing, I probably wouldn't have believed that, you know, go back about 7 years. But yeah, it's been a wild ride. It's been a lot of fun.
So maybe just give our listeners some insight into how, like, where you came from. Give us ground zero, because like nobody just rolled out of bed one day and had, you know, 600 million and you know, investable units there. And so like, what was the path? What was your journey that got you to that?
Yeah, and thanks again, guys. I mean, it's definitely the most fun I've had in the first like few minutes jumping on a show like this, really ever. And so I'm already having a blast. And I seriously think that the R in my last name somehow in another life was meant to be there.
Thank you.
Because it's been added. It's been added every time. So it's basically a member of my last name already.
I appreciate that.
No, it's all good, man. So I, you know, as you guys mentioned and teed up, and thank you for that, Dan. You know, I came from Silicon Valley, 13 years in software companies. I never planned on that. You know, it's weird for me to still say I spent 13 years specifically in like fintech. I guess that's a cool way to say that, like fintech, financial tech companies. So flash forward all that time, my wife and better half, who's also my co-founder, Jennifer, you know, we started buying real estate locally after I got the bug. I mean, my last corporate gig was actually in a real estate tech company called Lending Home, which is now the biggest actually fix and flip lender in the country. So when I got there, I mean, I was tasked with going in and scaling their loan origination groups, you know, so we were doing like 150 fix and flip transactions per month when I got there. And I had to go, you know, basically through a hardcore boot camp of sorts. You know, we scaled it from 150 a month to 600 transactions a month. And on nights and weekends, I really just got the bug for real estate specifically because I saw the zeros behind all these transactions, right? And I saw how much the investors were making, but it opened my eyes, you know, and so I can't swing a hammer. You know, I really didn't like the notion of flipping. I know a lot of people like flipping. A lot of my coworkers are trying to get me into flipping. But not only can I not swing a hammer, I mean, I like predictability. You know, I like investing in ways and just basically business plans and scaling businesses in ways that are predictable and proven and all that wonderful narrative that goes into being a good steward of a business. Apply that to real estate. And I looked at like bigger deals, you know. So eventually we started small, bought locally, bought a duplex, paid too much money for it here in California. Eventually found turnkey investing, bought some turnkeys, which were actually about to sell. It's finished selling right now. And now we only invest in larger deals, both as limited partners, passively as LPs, but also now actively a managing member of many different syndications and general partnership teams, both in storage as well as multifamily. But I mean, the thing I used to be embarrassed about bringing up as well, guys, is that like I actually grew up in a real estate household. My dad was a broker in the Bay Area, California, for 30 years. So he was one of the top performing residential real estate brokers. So he was making me run open houses for these really, really baller mansions, you know, back when I was like 15. And so I did not enjoy that at all. I wanted to run away screaming from real estate from that experience. And I went into tech because that's what's cool, you know, when you're young and fresh out of college. And so that, you know, that's how I found myself in a 13-year career in technology companies instead. But it's funny the twists and turns where life takes you, because I couldn't be happier now, because now all day, every day, I get to wake up and help other people do real estate investments the right way alongside us.
That's very cool. Now, it's interesting, you kind of hearing your evolution from being in the corporate space and ending up now in the real estate space. And you kind of mentioned there, you saw all the zeros. And so you were aware of the money that could be made, but it sounds like there were some other things that really attracted you to the real estate business model, as opposed to, you know, just the money, right? Because you can make money doing a lot of different stuff. So was it like the simplicity and the scalability of it that attracted you? Because I know that's what really kind of drew me in. What was it that you that made you kind of fall in love with it, aside from obviously being able to build wealth and all that good stuff?
And interestingly, I want to interject there too. Why did you jump into like duplexes and turnkey properties first? Mm-hmm. Like why that logical jump?
Yeah, I mean, both really good questions, right? I mean, I think I'll probably take the second one first because it leads well into the second, or into the first one. So, you know, I think it's intimidating as I say, heck, it's intimidating to go do real estate stuff in general. I mean, starting with buying your first home. I mean, like it's a milestone that unfortunately most people in the United States will never even be able to hit. Right. Yeah. And so for those of us that are fortunate enough to have gotten there, you feel like you've conquered this huge challenge by the time you actually close on your home. And then all of a sudden you're like, wow, great. Now I have to pay this huge bill every month and it doesn't bring me any more income. I actually have to pay it out. I promise that won't be a segue into a Rich Dad Poor Dad comment. So for our recent discussion.
That's okay. We're going to have our editor just kind of bleep that out. So that no references to Rich Dad Poor Dad here. Nope. Yeah,
it's like Fight Club. We don't talk about
it. We don't talk about that.
Yeah. That's right. And so it's just intimidating. Real estate is much like a lot of other archaic, old school industries. It relies very heavily on jargon. And it likes to keep people distanced and likes to keep people thinking that it is overly complex, because that way the people who are already deeply entrenched in that, have their hooks into it, have their livelihoods banked on it, they can keep it as this like never changing, you know, industry where they get to have a monopoly on the way that they run business.
It's like
they
don't want it to old boys modernize. Club kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. You know, like the smoke filled rooms where people can make decisions and keep the lay people out because then they win. And so I looked at it that way and I had a lot of that same fear. So did Jennifer. So we went and we started small. We didn't want to buy sight unseen. We didn't like the idea of not being able to physically drive and see and literally touch and walk within a property, which was in hindsight kind of irrational. You know, I mean, we drove around literally with our infant first son in the car for a whole summer. I mean, and we tried to find one property and we eventually got one. We bought it and then suddenly we had a property and we're like, well, that actually wasn't nearly as scary as we thought it would be, you know? And so $200 a month in cash flow for a $430,000 duplex is not what you call a home run from cash flow investing perspective. And I just didn't get that at the time. I thought, and sure, it's appreciating. It's gone up in value. We're happy about that. And it will play a key role down the line, you know, in terms of like maybe a legacy wealth strategy, because now I understand how all that stuff fits together. But I would have done it differently, you know, as a cash flow investor, because I want to generate income in multiple income streams. And so that is why we went and bought a duplex locally. It was just, we were scared. We were scared of buying sight unseen. We didn't think we could trust people far away. And so that was kind of the first comment. I already forgot the first question, so you have to remember.
Ah, see, my question was better. That's what that means.
Yeah, my question was, you know, what attracted you to real estate? I guess what made you switch from, you know, you were in fintech for 13 years. That's, I'm assuming, like very much your comfort zone. And I know anytime you go from, you know, the golden handcuffs, especially out on the West Coast in that industry, you're probably getting paid quite well. It's got to be a daunting task to go from that, you know, biweekly paycheck and all the benefits that you get from that career to going out and doing your own thing. And your livelihood is made or lost by what you do any given day. So I'm kind of wondering what got you to make that big switch. And from your intro that you did for yourself, it sounded like it wasn't necessarily the amount of zeros and commas that you could add to your bank account.
Yeah.
For myself, it was, you know, the scalability and the simplicity of the business model that was just like, okay, it just made so much sense. So I was kind of curious on your end, what really tipped the scale and made you take that leap?
Yeah. And I do think that is a very good question. And so I think for me, I looked at where I was and took stock of our circumstances first. I'd like to think, you know, not to get too corny and pontificate here, guys, but I'll just say every major decision and move that someone makes in life comes from both a push and a pull, right? Mm-hmm. There's things that are, we're moving away from, we're moving toward. And I think for me, the kind of push was that, we were growing a family. We have two young boys now. They've grown up a little bit more. But I was working, you know, when people think about those grinding early stage tech companies, I was working 80 to 100 hours, you know, per week. And that was really exciting. I learned an incredible amount. And I'm so grateful to have gone through that. It was awful. And in hindsight, you know, it strains your relationship. It strains your life. And so that was the push. And it kind of prompted me to go look a little further. Frankly, this is worth mentioning for people because I think it hits home when I've shared it for others, according to what they tell me. You know, I was fortunate enough to have like a meaningful amount of equity in an early stage company that could still have a pretty substantial IPO or liquidity event. And that's kind of the price, you know, you pay with sweat equity, with blood, sweat, and tears to get into these early stage companies and crush it there. But then hopefully you have some big Uber or Google or Facebook moment, right? Mm-hmm. So I say all that because someone asked me around that time, dude, like you could actually see a seven-figure exit from this. What are you going to do with that money? And I had no good answer. And I was like, well, let's go put this in an index fund. I don't know. And I felt pretty stupid. And I was like, well, this is clearly going to need a better answer. And I don't even know if I were to get it, what I would do with it in a sophisticated sense. I mean, I had a substantial 401k. I felt proud. I felt very proud of that. But how could I change my lifestyle now? And that led me to this notion, Dan, of like, okay, I want a proven playbook. I want something that is truly a proven playbook in a larger sense as to how someone can build net worth massively over time, assuming that they're able to work hard and humble themselves and learn and build relationships that are authentic and do all these things that are not rocket science. And so proven playbook, real estate is that. I mean, assuming that you can go out and ignore all the many distractions, all the terrible advice that's out there, and focus and hone on the good stuff and just stay true to yourself, yada, yada, yada. So I think a proven playbook was what I was looking for. And predictability as told by numbers. I think that data is like the great equalizer. As a guy who is actually not nearly as much of a numbers person as people might tend to think, just because I like to include, you know, I integrate data into so many aspects of our business, as does Jennifer. But I'm actually not the guy that just sits around all day thinking about how to go and cut a spreadsheet. Sure, can I do that? Sure. It still comes down to working with people at its core. So I was like, wait a sec. I get to go do that all day, because coaching and relationships and helping and grow other people has been like the greatest joy, honestly, in my 13-year career. I was like in managerial roles for the lion's share of that. So I wanted a proven playbook. Go add income streams to your life. Remove volatility from having two working parents that are getting great income W-2-wise, you know, and frankly, it's like a level of income that a lot of people would aspire to, and they'd celebrate. But once you get there, you're like, the more I get promoted, the less time I seem to have. So this is not working. Fundamentally, this is a broken play. Like, the playbook needs to get rewritten for our life.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the impetus for it.
I love it. I think I love that you pointed out that proven playbook point, because I think that's something that a lot of people are missing these days, whether they're active in real estate or passive. Everyone's, you know, so enthralled with, like, whether it be Bitcoin or, you know, the next tech startup or like the hot new thing. And it's like, there's this thing over here that has pretty much generated the majority, if not all, of humanity's wealth over the years, which is land values. You know, it might be, you know, you could farm it, you could put income producing property on it, you could put a business on it. But at the end of the day, if you look at where the majority of people in human history have generated their wealth, it's been some kind of land ownership. And like, you don't need to recreate the wheel. Like, this thing has worked throughout pretty much every economic cycle, with the exception of a few asset classes during a few phases. But by and large, that business model works great, and there's no reason to go and try and do something different. So I can relate to that 100%.
And I think this is a really good segueing point, actually, because you mentioned, Spencer, that it is a proven plan, but you have to get down kind of through all the sifty, you know, junk, because there is a lot of junk out there in terms of investing advice. We all hear it and we know it. But you know, for a new investor who doesn't know the wheat from the chaff yet, it can be daunting. You can be very easily misled and go down the wrong path. So that brings us to, I think, our bad investing tip of the week, or bad investing advice. When you were first starting your transition, or like where you're at right now, like, what is the piece of advice that you're hearing the most frequently where you're like, no, I just do not agree with that?
Yeah, this is
probably a long list.
Yeah.
It's a tough one to curate. I would probably say, and this is even going to tie back to recommendations if people ever want to ask, like, what's the right books to read and stuff. I think that there's the narrative of, okay, massive action, right? Go take massive action. And I agree with that. I agree with that first part of it.
Sounds good.
It sounds really good. You know, 10X, you know, and of course, you know, you have like the guys like Uncle Jeezy out there saying stuff like that. But in truth, it's dangerous advice. And it's dangerous because most people don't understand that before they take massive action, it's their job to decide where to place it. And that is the single most important thing that they do. And everyone in bigger pockets, everyone that is going out to meetups, people at conferences, I'm not saying I did this right. I clearly didn't. I went out and bought a duplex that cost almost $500,000. And then I bought a bunch of turnkeys before I found our strategy. So I don't have some role model here of perfection, guys, just to be clear. I'm not walking on higher ground. That said, people will take this massive action and they'll do it before they even go out and sit there and ask themselves, what do I enjoy spending my time on? How much time do I realistically have to go and do this thing? And even more fascinating to me is, and this might be timely, because I think I even posted this like again this morning on LinkedIn, because I keep getting individual messages every time I post it. I post it three times. Is this notion of like this boomerang investor, great example to hit the point home. Every month now, I hear from a person that I spoke to like 2 to 3 years ago. And there's someone who at the time, they had just finished devouring podcasts. Same thing I went through. You know, they found the bug. They got bit by the real estate bug. They're devouring podcasts. They are reading like hardcore, just like I did. They're in it, you know, and you guys have gone through this too. Like, you love this stuff, but you're so blinded by, I can do everything and I can take on the world. you start to DIY everything under the sun, mm-hmm. and you think that you are the person who's going to go out and do that burr project, and you want to do all of it. Like, you're like, I can do it. But what they don't stop and do and ask themselves is, okay, just because I can, does that mean I should? And may they find out the hard way 2 years later when they reach out, and I talk to them again, and they say, Spence, that this is a true story. This happened with like 3 or 4 investors that have actually invested with us now. They say, you were right. I went off and I did that project. It was a lot harder than I expected. And I spent X amount of money. And I think I should have done passive because I actually didn't like it as much as my job. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty eye-opening conversation, right? And so like it both invigorates me because it makes me want to go help other people to avoid that misstep legitimately, you know? I'm not trying to get them nudged into a passive investing syndication here, guys. Like, I'm the guy, I guess anyone doesn't know this already from listening to a dozen other conversations I've had out there. I'm the guy who tries to talk people out of it if they're trying to find a different strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not for everybody. So mm-hmm. like, you got to slow down and ask yourself, what are you trying to do? Like, are you trying to go, do you like rehabbing? Cool. Maybe a flip is for you. Maybe a burr strategy is for you. Do you want to do syndication? Hell no. You're going to feel uninvolved. Mm-hmm. You're going to feel like you are on the backseat of this bus and you want more of a say. So it's not a good fit. So long story short, very short question, very long-winded answer. I think people take massive action. It's not aimed at anything. And they haven't taken the deliberate step to slow down, just slow things down, man. And like, go out and ask yourself, like, what do I want to do with my time? What do I enjoy? What do I enjoy, like, activities wise? Like, literally write down how you want to spend your ideal day in like 5 years from now. And if you think that's stupid, you're missing out on like the most helpful, powerful planning exercise that I've ever personally done. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so anyways, hopefully that rant was coherent.
There's just so much good golden information and thought process there that I don't know if we'll have enough time to even start unpacking it all. So for you listeners at home, make sure that you go back and re-listen to that, because, you know, Dan and I talk all the time about you have to understand your outcome before you start. It's like I think the Marines have a saying, understand how you're going to get out before you go in. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a clear vision of what your desired outcome is, then you will never get there. And you can even still have that desired outcome clearly formalized in your mind. But if you don't choose the right vehicle to get you there, then it's all for naught. And it's very, you know, we talk about the jumbo jet investing strategy, which is really just a metaphor for syndication. And we could extrapolate that out and we could say, okay, so let's say single family home fix and flips. That's like a motorcycle. And your goal is to get to the place where you're just passively, like, you have all the free time in the world. You don't have a lot of tax liability. You get to spend, you know, days with your family. You just collect money. Well, that's like saying, I want to fly from Minnesota, or I want to get from Minnesota to France, and I'm going to take a motorcycle there. That's not going to get me there. I might get closer. I'll get to the very tip of Florida, or, you know, if I'm lucky, I can get that's about as close as I can get, but I'm never going to get there. Right. And so don't mistake progress for actually, like, or mistake, you know, action for making meaningful progress towards your goal. Because at the end of the day, some of these investment vehicles or strategies, they won't get you where you want to go. And so, but it's hard to know that at the very beginning, right? Like, when you don't know what you don't know and you're drinking from the fire hose of possibility. So I'm curious, not knowing what you don't know, how do you make the right decision or a meaningful decision?
Yeah, gosh, that is the big question, right? Truly. Like, I think, I feel like I almost have like a cheat code for that. That was really hard to find. And I'm oversimplifying it, because basically when I first got into this stuff, I'm taking a big breath because I'm like, how do I explain this simply and quickly? I knew I had a counterpoint example of a couple coworkers. I was working inside a flip company and I saw multiple coworkers that are brilliant. And they've actually gone off since and built like a fix and flip business that is thriving in another part of the country. And they're just absolutely crushing it. And one of them in particular, who I'll keep anonymous, he told me how his significant other wanted nothing to do with it and wanted to just not be involved in that business. And that was his thing. They weren't married yet. Wonder if they are now. So I'm being a little snarky because it's fascinating to me how often people think that their number one relationship in their life isn't going to play a role in them becoming a full-time or significant part-time real estate investor. So I slowed down and I was like, I committed to myself and I was like, I'm either going to help involve Jennifer and have her and I be co-founders of our organization, or I'm just not going to do this, period. Because everyone's allowed to have, you know, I'm getting a little bit preachy on the relationship personal front, but I think people mistake it. They think they're decoupled. Your business and your marriage are not decoupled. Or you'll find this out the hard way, by the way, 10 or 20 years from now. So I either wanted to deepen that relationship and also be going to business with her because we had two very successful separate careers, or, you know, we would just have to step away from that. And so long story short, we had two very, very hard weekends where we planned and literally did that planning exercise together with Jennifer and I. And it was formative stuff. You know, I mean, there was laughter, there was tears, full cycle both days. and by the end of that, we walked out with like a very clear plan of like with actual numbers behind it of when we wanted to hit certain milestones, of how we wanted this to go. And I think that that is the type of people just need to dig, you know, they got to dig inward and they got to figure out what kind of conversation they want to have and reorient their life. And you can't do the easy version. If you want to go find the right strategy more quickly, you can't do the topical, let me go to a meetup, listen to a talk, do a spreadsheet, go buy a rental, and suddenly you find yourself in the right strategy for the rest of your life. Yeah. You have to go and find out and have some tough conversations that might require you to break down in tears. So yeah. Like, ask yourself, like, or how honest with yourself are you being about what you enjoy? If you find yourself talking yourself into activities that you think you totally enjoy, by the way, you know, quote unquote, I love underwriting deals. Well, great. You're going to go do it about 1,000 times over the next decade. So I really hope you're being honest with yourself. Sorry for the breach.
No, that's great. I'm so glad you said it because I've had conversations with so many people, whether they've come to me because they want to get into real estate and they want to, or they think they want to be really active and do what we do, or they're just passive investors and I'm trying to help them figure out, you know, what their long-term goals are. Cause I've noticed that a lot of people haven't thought that far ahead. They just know that mm-hmm. they need to invest in something and they're just, you know, doing the shotgun approach, trying to learn as much as they can, but they haven't thought about what they want to be doing in 20, 30 years. And, you know, when I've actually had that conversation with people across the board, I think the most common answer, I guess the most common conclusion that we come to is that, you know, it's probably not 1,000 to 5,000, let's see, where are you at? Yeah, 5,000 goals, or I'm sorry, 5,000 doors that'll make them happy. It's not, you know, $1 million a year in passive income. It's just enough to free up their time. I feel like that's yes. the most common conclusion is I just want time to be able to decide what I do. And you don't need to be GC level. You know, you don't need to be Grant Cardone.
I'm sorry, who?
General GC. Contractor.
General contractor. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You don't need to, you know, you don't need all that to make the average person that I talk to happy. So I think right. the point that you made where you just start with the end of mind, you know, what is it that's going to make you happy at the end of the day? And then, you know, reverse engineer what you actually need to do to get there is key. And I think also I want to kind of hit on this too, the fact that you're making the partner in this in these conversations a part of it as well is huge, because I go through this on a daily basis. I think Anthony does as well. And I've had countless conversations with investors where they, you know, one person is kind of starting down this rabbit hole and the other person's kind of over here, and we'll, you know, we'll go and clue them into what we're doing later. It doesn't really work that well. You know, mm-hmm. you've got to be proactive, because this is one of the biggest things that you are going to be doing outside of buying your home is, you know, how are you going to, you know, plan the rest of the next 30 years of your life, financially speaking. So I love that you brought that up. That's hugely important.
This reminds me of, you know, we talk a lot about the American dream and how one of our goals in a podcast like this, or in any of the educational materials we put out there, is to help people realize that the American dream, as it was sold to them, isn't necessarily the right dream for them. You know, like go to school, get a job, buy a house, invest in a 401k, retire when you're 65. Like that's the American dream in some, for a lot of people. And one of our goals is to help wake people up from that. But what ends up happening, I find a lot of times, is when you wake up from the one dream, you immediately then pivot and you start looking for the next dream. And then the next dream is the GC dream. Like, oh, I guess if I'm waking up from the American dream, I need to buy a jet and I need to have 5 homes, I guess. Like, that seems like a dream because, like, it's so much easier to latch on to other people's dreams than to sit down and do the hard work of, like, okay, what is it that I really believe in that I want my life to stand for and the impact I want to have? That, unfortunately, you know, I asked you that question, like, how do we create a strategy or make that plan? And it's a loaded question because, you know, there's not a resource. You can maybe find a mentor. They can help you ask the right questions. But at the end of the day, you have to answer them. And that's hard. It's hard work. And there's no substitute for it. And it takes time, takes energy. But ideally, if you do it, then coming out the other side, you have a plan. And that's better than where you were at least before, where you were just dreaming somebody else's dream.
Oh, man. Yeah. You're giving me the feels. I feel like the last comment you made, just to kind of opine on that one. I think it's fascinating looking back at so many of the messages that resonated with me when I was still working full time, and they resonate with every person out there that has a full time job. Right. And, I it's interesting because I didn't hate my day job, right? Like I mentioned earlier, I was going through a particularly challenging moment, you know, working 80 to 100 hours a week at the time when I was kind of feeling that. That was one company. I mean, like I look back at the journey and the arc of my corporate career, and I think of joy, you know, largely. I think of hundreds of excellent relationships. I think of like lifelong friendships. I think of people that I literally have a texting every day relationship with, who I met because of that career. So most people are not coming at this notion of this passive income, financial freedom, financial independence perspective from that. I think, unfortunately, I think a lot of people do have jobs that they hate. And that is not only a bummer, it leads them astray, right? I mean, it leads them astray. It leads them thinking that they'll find inherent happiness and know how to fill the time. and so like, that is a dangerous proposition because, I mean, humans are happy when we're moving forward, making progress on something challenging. We're not happy when we're sitting on a beach. And so that's a whole separate therapy session, but it's a fun one.
Yeah, I love it. That's fantastic. I think you hit on so many points that we talk about repeatedly. So it's so good to hear someone kind of reiterate the same kind of concepts in a different way and relate it back to their life. It's super valuable. I'm curious now, you know, obviously you've built this massive portfolio, and from the sounds of it, you started, you know, quite small duplexes and some turnkeys. Like, how did you get from there to 5,000 units, 600 million? And is that assets under management? Is that what that number is? Or
no.
Is that capital raise?
Yeah. So we are, just I gave you and your listeners some background. So, we are deliberately a co-sponsor that actually does a bunch of stuff depending on the partnership. So we focus on storage, focus on multifamily. I'm also like a registered representative now, registered securities professional. So I take two roles in our partnerships, you know, basically a managing member of the general partnership on syndicated deals, as well as a placement agent, because that allows me to do things more at scale. And also, you know, sometimes I don't necessarily want to be on a managing member of a deal if it's something that I just want to help work on. So, we are a co-GP firmly.
I love it. So that seems like it's, my guess is, I don't want to answer the question for you, but I'm assuming that your goal there is to basically maximize efficiencies, right? Find where you can add value to particular deals and not do the, you know, like the DIY comment that you made before, where you don't necessarily need to be the guy pulling all the levers, doing all the things. You kind of find opportunities where you can insert yourself, add value, do your specific things really well, and strategically partner with others to scale, from what I could tell, exponentially. Because I guess, how many years are we talking about here? You were in fintech for 13 years. How long did it take you to go from those first duplexes to your current standing here?
Yeah, we're a little over 4 years now.
That's fantastic.
It was pretty fast. The same phrase that we apply to parenting with young kids, right? Is like, what's the phrase? The nights are long and the years are short, right? And so that applies here for sure. Yeah. It's like, depending on how deep we were into one particular deal, it felt like a slog. But yeah, they answer your question. Yes. Playing to strength is something that is just inherently a great idea. I look at the way I view business decisions in general, not just with real estate, not just within a market, not just within a partnership, and not just within the economics of a business plan for a 400-unit apartment building. It's about frameworking, right? And as a passive investor, whether you're purely passive and you just want to, like, you know, sit on the jumbo jet, to use the jumbo jet analogy from earlier, which is a great one, or you're active, I think it's important that you have your own framework on how you go into this stuff, because that's the same way I look at, like, what role can I best play in a given partnership? And granted, we are a little bit slower, actually quite a bit slower and more deliberate when working with certain partners. Like, for example, I've been approached by brilliant, successful sponsors in the last week, multiple times. And they say, hey, we'd love to have you partner in this deal. And I have to tell them, well, here's our, that I appreciate that. And I'd love to get to know you. Here, we don't jump into deals with strangers. So here's how our three-part process: build a relationship in the real world. You know, usually it takes 3 to 6 months. That's not a hard and fast rule. Mm-hmm. Invest money, like put in money as an LP, as a limited partner first, with this team. Let it run for about, you know, a few cycles at least. See how they operate. See that they're not a Ponzi scheme. See that they're, you know, that they are going to do good reporting. They actually communicate at the standard of 2021, not 1995. AOL.com addresses will not make a good impression. I will literally not walk away because of that. So last but not least is, like, put someone through an investigative background check, which is, like, well worth the $700. You know, so it's like all of these things happen, and then we decide, okay, like, I think we can go work with you on the next deal. Like, let's figure this out. You know, so it's a more deliberate, slow approach.
I like
that. And it really helps us make, I think, decisions thoughtfully, and also know, frankly, if we're going to be able to add material value to a partnership, because I don't want to go in and have it be like a vanity thing. I want it to be like, sure, we're going to help on equity capital and we're going to bring investors, and sure, we're going to help with investor relations. But, like, literally right now, I mean, we're about to launch like an $18 million storage fund. And I mean, I think, you know, we're doing a bunch more than that. So it takes a village, and you've got to find partners who really are a good complement to you.
That's it. I'm glad you mentioned that fund there, because that kind of leads into my next question here, is what's next? You know, you've got the 5,000 units, $600 million here. Now, you mentioned the storage fund. What is next for 2021 and beyond? Are you guys shifting your focus at all? Are you going to keep doing the same thing, just bigger and better? What's coming out of the pipeline?
Yeah. You know, I appreciate you teeing it up. I think for us, back in Q3 of 2019, coming into COVID, you know, didn't know it was coming, of course. My crystal ball doesn't work like everybody else's. I saw that, like, multifamily has still been and will continue to be, like, the core asset class that we have focused on. However, storage has been a growing part and is now our primary focus for 2021. So that's why I already love markets like Texas. Texas has also been our number one kind of geographic focus, beyond the Carolinas and Colorado and Idaho. But I love Texas. COVID has still made Texas even more attractive now, because big companies
down there.
Yeah, there's a heck of a lot of space. I mean, Dallas alone, as a dumbass Californian going out there for the first time a few years ago, I was like, oh, cool. You got, like, what, almost 200 cities literally within the Dallas metro. Like, that is bonkers. And so, yeah. Anyways, storage, believe in the asset class. We're going to be focusing there, doing a big fund there. And passive investors. We actually just launched a new website just this week with a new new portal, so people can actually register and just take a look at the basics there without having to do a phone call, which we used to require.
Yeah. Is that Matt? That's not madisoninvesting.com, is it? Is that a different?
That is, yeah. Madison, okay. Thank you. Yeah, madisoninvesting.com. You know,
look, so at I that think plug, man, Dan, you're a pro.
Yeah, it's like you've done this before. So I would say that's kind of the current focus for us. I think beyond that, I am not the empire guy, you know, like coming back to the goals discussion earlier. I just want to be a great dad. I want to be a present husband. I want to play some guitar. And I think that ultimately we want to show up extraordinarily well for our investors. And I think that is that is my reality currently, right? Which is, we just want to do well enough and thrive on behalf of our investors. And so that's the name of the game right now.
I love it. I love it. And that's a great way to tie it up too. I mean, it relates back to like everything we've been talking about here. You've figured out what it is you're trying to achieve, and you're staying true to that. You're still growing, but you're not getting caught up with, you know, achieving bigger and better numbers to infinity. It's being a good dad, being a good family, creating a strong family, and being happy, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Yeah. I can't think of a better spot to start wrapping up on there. I do want to transition though, before we let you out of here, Spencer, and get your book recommendation for the week. So we set some parameters before we went live. Told you can't recommend certain books. We're tired of hearing about that. No.
A lot of rules on this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. We're rigid, very authoritarian. For you listeners at home, we just want to ensure the best listening experience for you. So what is your book recommendation?
Gosh, man, all the pressure.
I swear on this podcast, just so you know.
Gee whiz. oh gosh, don't open that can of worms. I will have to go with Essentialism.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good one.
That has got to be my number one most recommended book. And it's not a real estate book. You know, read it. I mean, I say read it. I'm a big audiobook guy these days because of a time efficiency thing. I could do it when I run. So I've listened to it 3 times and I've recommended it dozens, and I love it because it comes all the way back to that whole tangent that we just went on talking about massive action and how it's the worst advice. Because busy does not mean productive, and that book arms you with actual ways and phrasing to say no. And I think that is where people miss the mark. Everyone's like, yes, for the sake of comfort zone expansion. So people go say yes to stuff that is outside their comfort zone. Well, duh, yes, they should. And I'm happy to help get on the phone and help people get that motivation to get there. However, the bigger problem once they get there is saying yes to everything. And what they need to do is just understand you should be saying no a lot after you get the momentum that, you know, that you need just to get started. You shouldn't be signing up for literally every meetup. You shouldn't be signing up for every mastermind. You shouldn't be going to every single conference. You should be going and doing the focus that you committed to.
Yeah, this, oh man, so this is perfect. Yeah. So my favorite
right now,
favorite book of all time is Meditations by Marcus Aurelius. And he has a quote in there, which is, "The key to a happy life, to do less, better." And it reminds me of Steve Jobs, who said, you know, for all the things that we've done that I'm infinitely proud of, I'm more proud of all the things that we said no to. And yeah, you just nailed it on the head there. So Essentialism, go check that out. I recommend that book. It is fantastic. And Spencer, where can people get a hold of you? Kind of already dropped a little bit of info on madisoninvesting.com. Sounds like there's a portal there that we can go and sign up for. Is there any place else people should be looking for you?
Yeah. And just to double down on that, the website's brand new, really easy to use. So people should check that out. But LinkedIn, I mean, I think you guys already know this, but I don't really spend a lot of time on other social media, but I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. And it's just been a wonderful way to connect, and people can read my internet rantings in the morning. So that is, feel free to just send a connection invite or send me a message. I promise I won't bite.
Yeah, definitely check them out. It's something that I appreciate about the content that you've put out is you're very well spoken. You know how to articulate things very well. So as far as just communicating to people, there's so much content out there. It's just yours is just so consumable, whether you are an astute investor or pretty new. So
thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and I'll piggyback on that. I think you say things in interesting ways that isn't just regurgitation of what other people said. That's my stick. That's what I do, is I just quote other people, right?
I noticed that.
Yeah, but yeah, that's, and it makes me look smart. And they're like, oh, he's smart. But you say things in original, interesting ways. So I appreciate that about you. And I appreciate you taking the time to join us here today.
Yeah.
For you, dear listeners out there, we appreciate you taking a little bit of time out of your day as well to join us. And we'll catch you next week. Hey, thanks for joining us for another episode of Multifamily Investing Made Simple. If you enjoyed the show, could you do us a massive favor? Head over to iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review. Your feedback, it means the world to us as it helps us grow and spread the word about multifamily investing. And don't forget, sharing is caring. So fire this episode over to any friends or family who you think could benefit from learning all about multifamily investing. Thanks, guys. We appreciate every single one of you, and we'll see you on the next show.